This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized, and with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com, that's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to Tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
If you're going to face a real challenge, it has to be a real challenge. You can't accomplish anything without the possibility of failure. Lazarus Lake.
It was not there. So I didn't look at my watch. I was like, there is nothing else I can do. So yep. I started to move again.
Incredible. What mental toughness to just stick to what you know. So that's incredible.
Yeah.
did you leave anything there at all? That's happened a few times in the past, and people have left, like, you know, a little wrapper or a bit of food or something at that spot to prove that they were there, at least.
Yeah, I didn't think about that, but I didn't redo the cairn. I put the rocks on the, I let the rocks on the floor, so the cairn was not there anymore. So I was gonna tell that, okay. But I didn't. Yeah, that was only my story.
I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod.
Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Lace up those boots and sling on the pack for a romp through trails, short and long. With your host and Renaissance man, Doc, it's time to embrace the suck.
Welcome back to another week of adventure, near-death experiences, and type 2 fun. I'm Doc, and this is the John Freakin' Muir Pod. Hey, if you like what we're doing here, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Help us move up the chart. And if you don't like it, well, just go ahead and keep that to yourself. All right, constant listeners, I have a special bonus episode for you this week. Our regular listeners know that I'm a little preoccupied. That's not quite the right word. I'm a little obsessed with the Barkley Marathons. And this past March, we had some pretty incredible events happen at Frozen Head State Park, the home of the Barkley, including three finishers. And two of those three finishers are joining us this week. That's right. I am speaking to Aurelian Sanchez and John Kelly today. Welcome to the John Freakin' Muir Pod, guys. How's it going?
Going pretty well. Thanks for having us.
Doing good. Yeah, thank you.
And I'm sure that you have had a little time to recover, get back home. Where are each of you calling in from today?
So I'm up in Boone, North Carolina, Western North Carolina, up in the high country.
And myself, I'm in Toulouse, south of France. So it's a little bit later in the day, and it's sunny right here, right now. It's almost spring, almost summer. It's getting nice for getting some trail runs currently.
Nice. And to kick things up a notch or two, I am joined by my special co-host for this episode, endurance athlete, wilderness celebrity, and former Barkley competitor, Mr. Jeff Garmeyer. Welcome back, legend.
Thanks. Yeah. Celebrity. Wow.
Absolutely true. Absolutely correct. He's on a, currently you're on a barnstorming tour for your documentary that's out right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Stepping away from the trails and into the theaters. That's what we're doing.
And how's it going? What's been the reception of the film?
So far, so good. Yeah, it's been fun. But yeah, excited to dive into some Barkley talk. Yeah,
absolutely. Let's spend most of our time there.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to. Can I start off with a question here?
Go right ahead. That's why you're the co-host.
Yeah, I think John, your approach to things is fascinating. So I wanted to dive in. Could you just explain what so random forest runner? And then kind of the theory behind that too, because I think it gives a good insight into this intersection of passion in the forest and then kind of your career and then work endeavors as well. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm a data scientist and a very well-known, highly used algorithm in this area is the random forest algorithm. It's a machine learning algorithm, and so it's the random forest runner is a bit of a play on words between that and what I like to do outside of work of just running through random forests. I've done a couple startups now, and one of my partners came up with that. We leave it to the business guy to come up with creative names like that. I'm just the tech guy on the keyboard.
Yeah. So which random forest started first?
Probably the geeky one, probably the data science one. I didn't really get back into running and doing these sorts of things until after finishing up grad school. Actually, my wife and I through hiked the John Muir Trail, and that was sort of the impetus of getting me back out there and reignited my love of the mountains.
Sweet. And then Aurelian, did you live in Flagstaff for a while, and then did you move to France, and then is that kind of when did you become familiar with the trail ultra running world, and even since you have a FKT on the John Muir Trail too?
I don't live in Flagstaff. I live in Phoenix. Between 2016 and 2019, just before COVID, I moved back to France for personal reason because I was missing my friends and family. I started hiking when I was in Phoenix. I spent my weekend in Grand Canyon, most of my weekends actually. And after some time, I was discovering long hikes, you know, and I was curious to learn about my limits. And I heard about the Barclay. So I heard about how people get into the Barclay doing FKTs and such. So I got into the John Muir Trail after that. So that's my process. I started hiking in Phoenix in the Grand Canyon and then got into ultra running this way.
So a big JMT connection here. I mean, we have three folks here who have current or former FKTs of the JMT. Is that correct?
No,
John has done it yet.
No, my wife and I took a nice, leisurely, enjoyable 17 days. You know, the sorts of things that sane people do.
There is past, present, and future here.
Maybe.
I love it. Yeah. Perfect. And then you've been out on the John Muir Trail too, Doc, right?
That's right. That's right. That's where it all started for me. So it's got a special place. Absolutely.
Sweet.
Now, John, with your data scientist background, what are your thoughts on this whole ChatGPT and AI and people calling for a 6-month halt on its development? I mean, should we be panicking here?
No, we're not quite there yet. It can do some impressive things. It's really the most dangerous thing with the current technology, honestly, is user error and people thinking that it's better than it is. I mean, ChatGPT, if it doesn't know something, it just completely makes it up and doesn't tell you. So there are going to be people that ask it questions. It's going to make something up and they're going to take it as the truth and make some disastrous decision on it. I was trying just a couple days ago, I've got to get a new heating system for our house. And I was asking it some questions to try to see the different energy use of different ones. And I was like, hey, about how many hours per year at my location is it below 40 degrees? And it just completely made up some number. And I was like, no, that can't be right. So it completely made up another number that was even higher. And I was like, no, that was the wrong direction. And it just, again, it gives no indication that it's not confident. It just says everything like it's 100% right, no matter how true it is or not. So I think that's the biggest risk at the moment.
Sounds like some of the conversations at the holiday gatherings with my family.
Yeah. Well, let's dive right into the Barkley. So, going into it, how did you choose your crew? Who were you going out there with? Did you have any contingency plans? Cause the start time's always unknown. Just take us kind of to that arrival at Frozen Head, which is probably just a short walk for John and quite a few flights for Aurelian. Go for it, John. You want to kick us off?
Yeah, that's, I think we maybe we'll alternate who goes first on these. So for me, I mean, it was a great experience to be back living closer to home. Like Aurelian, I had a stint overseas and moved back to be near friends and family again. And so just a relatively short drive for me and being able to stay there at my parents' house leading up to the race. And I had John Fegbressi coming back to crew for me, who is if you watched the original Netflix documentary, he's the guy that dramatically finishes towards the end of that and held the record for the slowest Barkley finish until Carl broke that this year. And he also crewed for me when I finished in 2017. So it was great to have him back. And I was excited to just get out there and get to welcome so many people to essentially my home course, my home mountains, and a lot of the runners that had supported me in my time in the UK were coming over to compete this year. And so I was able to help them out before the race as best I could and get to see them enjoy this experience. So it was something I really looked forward to and went in this year with the mindset of being able to truly appreciate it and not stress very much about the start time or the weather or any of the other things that really I can do nothing about.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just have to cross fingers for that. Exactly as you said, we don't have any control, so it's just what it is, and then we deal with it at the end. And on my side, I was a virgin this year. It was my first year, so I think as a virgin, we don't have any choice than to get the experience from a veteran. Mm-hmm. So that was my plan for this year. It was to learn about the course and everything at camp from a veteran, and luckily the veteran I was counting on was Guillaume Calmet, which is my friend also. We trained a lot in the Pyrenees together the last 2 months between January and February. So we already shared the training together. Then we went to the park about 10 days ago, 10 days before the race. So I could train on the trails, on whatever cool. Is allowed in order to see where we were going during race day. So it was such an important training for me, physical training, but also Guillaume was showing me the thing he was able to show me. So it was such a great time for me to get his experience. And my plan was basically it was to follow Guillaume most of the race. We are having fun to share trainings and racing together. So that was my plan, and then become autonomous as soon as possible, because I know at the Barkley, every time you have to be by yourself. So the first loop was about that for me, to share, to learn, to get as much as autonomy as I was able. And then at camp, I had Alexandre as well, who came especially from Toulouse. He's a very passionate person for this Barkley. He loves this event, so he was able to see the event on site and also to help me. So it was great to have him help me to make some transition very fast. So that was my plan for the first year, for this year.
Yeah, see, and
Jeff,
so
Jeff, he brought somebody passionate about the Barclay who wanted to see it in person. That's a very important fact right there.
Yeah, so it seems like you're signing yourself up, huh? Yeah. So Aurelian, it's pretty crazy, fun, exciting when that cigarette is lit. It's the most unique way to start a race. Were you nervous going into that? And then was it hard to stay with Guillaume at all when 40 runners are, you know, and maybe 100 yards are just compacting into a single track trail? Was it hard to stick with him? And was it wild out there? Or what was going through your head when that thing finally started?
Yeah, I was in the pack, so it was very strange. I was very, I don't know how to say, intimidated by John, by the people around me. I was watching this event on behind my computer, behind Twitter, and behind all the videos you can find afterwards. I was feeling like I was in a movie or living my dream, you know, around all those people. Yeah, there was Damian, there was Guillaume, there was such amazing field, Karel. So I was intimidated. I was like, I'm not at the right place. I have big goals for my race, but I know that everybody else around me is so strong and that I don't pretend to be stronger than anyone. So it was very intimidating. Intimidating. I don't know how to say. Anyway,
great,
I hope you got the point. And then I know we have the same pace with Guillaume. I was not really concerned at the beginning. I was turning around to see where he was. And we had the same goal as the first loop, which was between 9 hours and 9 hours 30, and he knows what he does as well. We didn't really want to be in the front at the beginning because we knew that 9 hours 30 would give us the right margin to finish five loops. So I was not stressed about that. I was just going at my own pace. We did 8 hours 45 minutes at the end, which was way faster than what we expected. So I was just fine with that. And I followed my pace. I was watching around Guillaume. We quickly were by ourselves on the first loop. And that's about it. But yeah, it was some strange feelings to live my dream and also to be around people that I was watching for this whole time.
Yeah. Definitely. And then, John, when you get... So you've talked about like showing people... your home mountains and stuff. Was that really the kind of how that first loop felt, especially since it is large packs just trudging behind veterans for the most part? Was it pretty cool to have that leadership role and bring along some of the new people?
You hear me now?
Yeah.
Cool. Sorry about that. I had to cut out for a second. There's a plumber here fixing a few things. But
even John
now.
Kelly, even John Kelly has to call a plumber once in a while.
Yeah, we had a bad pressure regulator, so every time he turned on the water here, the house just moaned like it was haunted by a legion of ghosts.
Wow. Haunted by Barclay finishers past.
But yeah, so it really is something that it's fun starting off, and as Aurelian mentioned, that first climb is always fun, just everyone together and getting to see everyone and greet everyone, wish everyone luck, and then once you start that first descent is where things start to spread out a bit, and you've got to start worrying about navigation. And you know, I mentioned earlier, I wanted to go into this race kind of stress-free and worry-free. And the most stressful part of the race for me is that first loop on some of those tough descents where I am leading the way. And I know that like there's a whole throng of people behind me that are just assuming that I'm right on path and they're counting on me to nail that book. And I'm always so nervous that I'm going to miss and then everyone's going to be messed up because of me. Fortunately on that first loop, I nailed all the tough descents, and those again are, the descents are generally much worse than the climbs because, you know, you're moving faster. And as you go down from a peak, all lines spread apart. So if you're a little bit off, you end up way over in the middle of nowhere, whereas going up, everything converges at the top. So it's a fun but stressful experience, I would say, at the beginning of the race for me.
Yeah, no pressure with everybody following behind, expecting you to know where everything is. Now, I know there's a lot of physical training that goes into preparing for the Barkley. You got to do 5 loops in 60 hours. But how do you train for the sleep deprivation and the decisions you have to make and the waypoints you have to find while being sleep deprived? Is there any way to prepare for that?
On my side, I'm not much training. I'm relying on my past experiences. I did John Muir Trail 3 times. I failed twice and succeeded on the third time. My second try was a great experience. I was in my third night without sleeping and I faced hallucination. I felt the lack of lucidity and I lost it on my third night because of that. And I'm always thinking about this third night where I had the hallucination and where I was not drinking and eating anymore. I was not doing the right things anymore. I'm relying mostly on my past experience where I remember every time I faced some issues during the night. And sometimes I just take some time to sleep when I really need. So 10 to 15 minutes, small naps are already very nice. Otherwise, I'm taking caffeine to get woken up sometimes. It helps. This is what I did at the Barclay. And hydrating, eating a little bit more. I'm trying to manage like this past on my previous experiences. But honestly, on my side, I'm not training that much. But I'm doing ultra, which is a good way to have the background on this difficulty, let's say. I know John has a good techniques for that as well, but
I mean, like Aurelian said, it's really just past experience. I don't think there's any way to train your body to need less sleep or to do better when sleep deprived, but what you can do is you can learn what to expect. And you can learn what works for you and how to handle it. I mean, for me, I know that there are certain times of day where my body's just going to hit a low point. Like it's just my circadian rhythm before and after sunrise, late afternoon, like 4 p.m. I'm going to get tired and sleepy. And I know that if I can just push through that little time window, then I'll pop out the other side and magically be fine. And so having that understanding, maybe proactively taking a bit of caffeine just before that can be a huge help. Knowing when to start caffeine, how much it does help me, and how long it is going to help me. Eventually, caffeine just doesn't do anything for me after a day or so of kind of relying on it. And at that point, it's knowing, you know, whether power naps work best for you or a longer sleep works best. For me, 60 hours is right at that threshold where, like, I think it's possible for me to do it without sleep. I never have. I've done a number of things in that time range, like Barkley this year, with about 20 minutes of sleep. And so it's just, for me, on demand, a lot of dirt naps, because that's when I know that I can hit the ground and be out cold, not waste any time, get that 15 minutes or so that's nice and refreshing, maybe take some caffeine right before I go down, and that's going to get me going again. The absolute worst thing is to try to force sleep, and like you lie there and can't fall asleep, and you're just wasting your time and getting nothing from it.
After 40 hours, I would take a dirt nap for 15 minutes and I'd wake up, you know, 12 hours later. That would be dicey for me. I don't know how you can wake up after 15 minutes.
Well, that's what I had to worry about this year. So we just get the like $10 cheap watches that Laz gives us, and the alarm didn't work on the watch that I was given. So that was a big concern for me on the last loop. And I was trying, and unfortunately, it was also a nice, warm, comfortable day. So I was like lying down in creek beds and muddy tire tracks and trying to pour water on myself and all these things to where, like, past a certain threshold, like after 15 minutes or so, my body would say, okay, I'm more uncomfortable than I am sleepy. So get up and get moving before you get too cold.
Do you think that was intentional? You think Laz went to the local Walmart and said, give me 40 watches with broken alarms on them. I don't want the alarms to work on them.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone else has worked or not. I think Damien's didn't work because we were together on loop four and ended up with him sleeping on top of the book, counting on the runner behind us to then have to wake us up.
That's an excellent strategy. Wow, I haven't thought of that.
Yeah, unfortunately, Albert was just like 30 seconds behind us, so we kind of laid down, and then there he was, no sleep, and kept going.
Yeah. What about you, Aurelian? Did you have any worries that you would take a dirt nap and not wake up for 2 days?
Yeah, I was preventing that. I wanted really to sleep at camp, and this is why I forced actually my sleep between loop three and loop four, just before the last night, just before the second night. And I was fortunately able to sleep about 10 minutes, I think, but which was really, really great. And after that, when I was on my first loop, I spent half of my loop with Karel. And at the beginning, I faced some issues. For 15, 20 minutes, I was seeing the trail blurry, not very right. I was falling asleep working, and with caffeine and hydrating, it helped me. Within 20 minutes, I got it back again. And when the day started again on the fifth loop, I was fine. I didn't need to sleep anymore. But yeah, I faced some issues on my second night. Thankfully, I was able to sleep a little bit more before, so it could have been worse. And as John, I just needed 15 minutes for the full race, which was amazing. I didn't know on paper if it was possible, but I didn't feel the need to do more when I was doing it.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the first book of the whole race. I remember when I got to it, it's just a mess of 40 people and everyone takes a minute or two to flip to their page and rip it out. Is that kind of when the race separates a little bit? And then there's some people with anxiety, you're waiting on someone who flips to the wrong page or anything, or how do you, you know, you've rushed to get to this book, you're in the Barkley and now you're kind of waiting in line to get your page number. Was that what took place this year as well?
So Jared kind of sacrificed himself at that point. It's like you say, that the mad rush and everyone is trying to get their page and get moving and not get scraped. Mm-hmm. And Jared just kind of calmly took the book and starts asking people's page numbers and ripping everyone's page out and standing there. I don't know if he saved himself for dead last or not, but, you know, brought order to the chaos there. And, but yeah, otherwise that first book can be a bit of a mess, and then things, you have a runnable portion. Mm-hmm. It is flat. It's pretty runnable in any terms, not just in Barkley terms, and then a descent. And so that does spread people out a bit. I find that generally when things really start to spread out and you kind of end up in probably the groups you might be with for the first two loops or even three loops, is on the third climb. I guess just at that point is where the adrenaline is worn off and people start to stop and think, oh, maybe this isn't the pace for me.
Now, the Barkley is unusual for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons is that, you know, in most races, there is a clearly defined course. I mean, you know exactly where you're going when you line up for the LA Marathon or a trail marathon or an ultra. You know where you're going. But the Barkley, the course changes a bit each year, and it's not clearly defined where it is. I think you're given a map at the very beginning, right? And when I say given a map, you're given access to a map, and you have to copy down the route. Is that correct? How does that process work?
Yeah, so I can start maybe this time. So I was new to that. Guillaume explained me the process. He showed me what he was able to show me. I was excited to see the map. I was excited to see where we were going exactly, what was the changes that we were going to face, the new books and etc. And I spent some time. I think I spent about 2 hours because I did two maps. I had two backpacks on my side and I wanted to change very fast with a new one, another one which was already ready. And as you said, I spent a lot of time doing the drawing the exact line to make sure when I was out there that I was analyzing properly where we are going. Because some people doesn't know. They think it's an orienteering event. It's not an orienteering event. You don't have to go from books to books. You really have to follow the course. You really have to follow the line. It's not about getting from book one to two to three, etc., or changing the number of books, doing one book before the other. You really have to follow the line, and this is important for the rules, for the course respect, let's say, because this is the background of the race. Before, there were no books. People were just out there following the course and going back. But then Laz and the runners didn't really know if they followed the race. So this is when he put books during the race. So this is very important to draw the line perfectly so that you're sure that you're on course. And as you said, sometimes it's difficult to know. But most of the time when you know the ridge, when you cross the river, you know that basically you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, that's my, at this point, my least favorite part of the race is having to draw the map and copy over all my compass bearings over. It's nice because only portions of the course change each year. And so I can kind of copy my old map and then just update it with the new portions. But starting out early on, you know, I had a map with every single thing I could pick out on Google Earth, like every old logging road, every little pond and stream and everything I added to my map. I had sight lines drawn to windmills that were on mountains like way off the map, but just knowing that like that would be a reference point for me at night, seeing those little blinking lights on the windmills. Now I'm kind of just like, I know where to go. Do I really need to do this? Yes, I should force myself to do it to refresh everything. But like Aurelian says, it is a course and it's not orienteering. And the other thing to add to that is just that it follows the natural lay of the land. And so if you try to approach it like orienteering, where you're just drawing straight lines between everything and then following compass bearings dead on, it's not going to work out for you. You've got to, you know, it'll go down a spur and then follow a creek and then go up another ridge line. And so it's a very natural flow to the course. And you have to be sure that you're on those terrain features, not just because that's where the course is, but because if you get off of them, that's where you get in trouble and you find yourself lost.
So what was your method of kind of following that natural lay, especially if you're tired? Do you have backstops in, like if I hit this, I've gone too far, or I know that I just have to get up to this ridge line, I don't have to nail the exact spot exactly? What was your process in having some of that info to work on, especially when you're getting quite tired and just having little checkpoints along the way? How did you guys approach that?
Yeah, for me, backstops and handrails are enormously important, of knowing, you know, if I hit this creek, I've gone too far and I need to go back up or turn left or right or whatever. And then also going down, having something on either side of me that is kind of guiding me to keep me on the right track, whether that be like a mountain laurel thicket or a gully or a creek or whatever. Those are bit more difficult, obviously, at night or in the fog, which we didn't have any fog this year, miraculously. But at those points, I am, especially at the tops of descents, I'm checking my compass bearing just to make sure that I'm headed in the general right direction. You know, again, it's not early on. It's 52.5 degrees, and here's my declination, and I try to nail it perfectly. But it's really just, you know, I'm going down the southeast spur instead of the south spur. Just make sure I get on the right one, and then I should be good.
Yeah, and on my side, I did I did several mistakes. There is two I have in mind right now. One of them was coming down some ridge. When I was at the bottom, I saw the river, which was flowing from right to left, while I was expecting it to flow from the left to right. So I knew I was not at the right place. So I analyzed my map, and I saw there were some two rivers crossing at some point. So I went to south on one of them. So basically, I corrected. I analyzed what did I do wrong? Where am I right now? So I took out the map and analyzed, and okay, I think I should be here. So I backtrack and trying to see where you're at and what is the river looking like, and And the other mistake I've done was going to a summit where I was expecting to find the book. I didn't find the book. Then I was thinking, you should have crossed a trail before the summit. And I didn't remind to have crossed a trail. So I started doubting that I was on the right summit. I look at the map and I saw there was an adjacent summit, a summit just more eastern to the one I should have been. And there is a trail going southern of the summit. So I saw on the map, okay, I think you're not at the right place. You went too far east that you should have. So I backtracked, found the actual trail going more northeast, and then was able to find the right summit. So you have really to analyze what you're crossing. I didn't cross a trail while I should have crossed a trail, which was an indicator. And when I was at the summit, I didn't lose much time looking for the books. I spent, I think, 2 minutes, and I was feeling that something was not right. So yeah, you have to expect where you're going, what you have to cross, and yeah, keep your eye open every time.
So how did you remain calm in that moment? Because being a virgin and, you know, just out there, sounds like at that point on your own, it sounds like a good recipe for spiraling or getting nervous and antsy. Were you internally freaking out a little bit, or how did you remain calm and rational and finding where you should actually be?
I was freaking out, but I was also expecting those moments to happen. This is Berkeley. I was expecting for a while ago to be on my own and to be lost and to not panic. Mm-hmm. And this was the situation. I was alone, I was lost, and I had to not panic, because if you panic, then you start to lose your race. So this was it. I was now I had to manage by myself and to analyze. So, of course, I had my heart rate going up. It was a moment where I was thinking that I could lose my race anytime. But I slowed down. I took out my map. I started analyzing, doing my best. I lost some time, but it was not crucial. Every mistake I've done many of them. It was never more than 15 minutes or 20 at the maximum for two mistakes. And it was fine.
As I'm going to go back to the beginning of the race again, Aurelian, as a Berkeley virgin, how far in advance, how much time in advance did you get to the course, and what kinds of activities did you engage in as you're waiting for the race to start? And then I want to hear from John Kelly, an experienced veteran Berkeley runner, you know, how that is different from his perspective.
Sorry, I didn't get your question on this time.
Yeah. So when you arrived to the race, how much in advance? I mean, were you there a day in advance, or hours in advance? Okay. And what kinds of activities did you partake in while you're waiting for the race to start?
So at the camp, I just arrived the day of the race, but I was there for 10 days before that, so I could train. I think every day we did 40K with Guillaume. A lot of training went into that, into the park. Then we had 2 days of resting, but we were in Oak Ridge. We were 10, 20, 30 minutes away from the park, and we were there. We went there every day to train on the trails, and then I went to the camp it was the same day for the race.
Okay. Don, how about
I drove down about a week in advance and met up with Damien Hall, one of my good friends and rivals from the UK, who was there for the first time this year, and I got to show him around. We did some good runs on the trails around Frozen Head, saw the sights, and had some good fun introducing him to some American cuisine, Sonic and Bojangles and the like, you know, all the finest that we have to offer. So it was just, you know, it was a nice week. Good to kind of get out in the park and in the right mindset for it. But again, just trying to enjoy that process leading up to the race.
So John, are there still areas of the course where you're, I guess, a little less confident, and are those ones you can't run the course per se, but at least think about or check out or think through? Are there areas where you're a little less certain still?
Yeah, there are a couple of the climbs, and like I mentioned early on, the parts that are a bit nerve-wracking for me on loop one, when I'm leading and yeah, everyone is expecting that I'm just 100% spot on all the time, and there are those spots where I'm not fully confident. Some of the newer sections, there's one in particular called the Meat Grinder that is, it's difficult to find a good line on it. I have done that now. Whether I can do that again in the future and nail it, who knows? But it's one of those where it's not necessarily just being able to stay on course, but one of those deals where, you know, 5 feet to either side might make the difference between running through a bunch of boulders or a bunch of undergrowth or all sorts of things, and knowing which line to take can make a big difference. So unfortunately, you know, you can't really check out those sections before the race. So it's about learning and focusing and remembering these things during the race.
All right. Hey guys, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to pay some bills. We're going to hear from our sponsors. And then when we come back, we're going to hear some more stories from Frozen Head State Park. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
From the backcountry to the backyard, we believe everyone deserves the highest level of protection. Since 1984, Sawyer Products offers the best, most technologically advanced solutions for protection against sun, bugs, and water, using time-released liposome technology, topical insect repellents, and new standards in water filtration. And with every Sawyer product you buy, you are helping to provide clean water through 140 charities in 80 countries with their long-lasting water filters. Every Sawyer product you buy is an investment in our common humanity. Choose Sawyer and keep the adventure going, knowing that their products have been tested and chosen by those who count on serious protection on the trail all day long. Six Moon Designs has been innovating ultralight backpacking gear for the past 20 years. With a wide range of products ranging from ultralight shelters to backpacks and accessories like their extensive line of trekking umbrellas, Six Moon Designs is sure to have a great piece of gear for your needs. With the company philosophy being that gear should aid one's experience, not define it, Six Moon Designs thinks the more time people spend outside the natural world, the better off this world will be. And remember, go wild, live young. This episode is sponsored by Jolly Gear. Are you tired of compromising between the ventilation of a button-down and the full protection of a sun hoodie? With the Triple Crown button-down, you can have the best of both. Plus, their fun standout patterns will have you the talk of the trail. Visit them at jollygear.com. Through hiker owned, Jolly Gear, where fun meets functional. Want to make a podcast? Spotify's got a platform that lets you make one super easily, then distribute it everywhere, and even earn money, all in one place for free. It's called Spotify for Podcasters, and here's how it works. Spotify for Podcasters lets you record and edit podcasts right from your phone or computer, so no matter what your setup is like, you can start creating today. Then you can distribute your podcast to Spotify and everywhere else podcasts are heard. Video podcasts are also available on Spotify. With Spotify for Podcasters, you can earn money in a variety of ways, including ads and podcast subscriptions. And best of all, it's totally free with no catch. Since I discovered Spotify for Podcasters, I feel like my creativity has raised to another level. I highly recommend you give it a try. Download the Spotify for Podcasters app or go to www.spotify.com/podcasters to get started. And welcome back. We are here today with Jeff Garmeyer, and we're talking to Aurelian Sanchez and John Kelly, finishers of this year's Barkley. Heard a lot of great information in that first segment. Jeff, where do we want to go with the second segment?
Well, I mean, naturally, we talked about the beginning and how there's a lot of people, especially following John through the woods, through his home woods, actually. But yeah, as it spreads out and everyone sets off on their own, I'm really curious how that kind of presents itself and if it's natural, or if you're waiting for people or clinging on, and then how you just naturally separate. And by the fifth loop, of course, everyone's going different directions. But about what point in the race do you start finding yourself alone, or maybe with just one other person?
For me, in general, things start to get fairly well defined about halfway through the first loop. And then, you know, depending on what size your group is, you'll have some people start to drop off. But for me, I was with Damien and Albert and Christoph for the first two loops, and then Christoph dropped back, and I was with Damien and Albert until about halfway through loop four, where I just kind of, I was on a climb and looked back and found that suddenly they weren't there. And so that's the sort of thing, you naturally just kind of identify people that are moving at about the same pace, and you can be mutually beneficial to one another up until the point that someone does have to drop back, or becomes starts putting out negative thoughts. Those seeds of doubt can be disastrous at Barclay. Those sorts of separations just naturally occur. But I was very impressed this year. There's one out and back section where you can kind of see where other people are. And on loop two, there were still like a dozen people at that point. I was like, wow, any of these people could still move well enough to finish. It was a few very strong groups, all with good veteran experience within them towards the front of the race. So it was definitely a strong year from start to finish.
Was that different than past years that you've done it? Have you not seen so much potential, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, generally in past years, by the time you get most of the way around loop two, there's kind of like, you know, the lead group still has a chance to finish. Here are the people that still have a chance for a fun run. I don't think I've ever seen it where that deep into loop two, I look at the field and I'm like, wow, there's a dozen people here that are at this point still moving well enough. And you know that some of them are going to drop off as in any race. But it was, I mean, I think the best indicator of this is the fact that of the three of us that finished, none of us really ran together. Like, we were in separate groups pretty much the entire time.
Yeah. What about you, Aurelien? I know you were running with Guillaume, and was the plan just to, no matter what, stick together as long as you could, or was there contingencies if something came up too?
Yeah, exactly. That was the plan, but no commitment, you know. You're stronger when you're with a person usually, but you don't have to commit also, because when you're in a race, you know, we never know what happens. Mm-hmm. After some time, we slowed down, so I decided to move forward. This is where I started to move alone, I think, after half of the second loop. So I was alone by myself. And then when I finished my second loop, I saw Jared and Carrer moving away on the third loop. And I was thinking it would be nice for me to catch them up in order to avoid to make any orienteering navigational mistakes. So that's what I did. I was with Carrer, Jared, and Christoph for some time on the third loop. Then I spent some time with Carrer on the fourth loop, exactly for the same reason. I think we are stronger when we are with someone. But at some point, I was counting on Carrer as a veteran, and Carrer was counting on me to shut down his brain sometime when he was falling asleep, because the help of someone else, you know, you can just rely on working behind. And this is what Carrer was doing at some point, and he was not fixing my error soon enough. So we were doing navigational mistakes that we should not have made because of me rushing into the climbs and the descents. So at this point, I decided to move forward to accelerate. It was half of the loop in order to catch the front runner and also to focus on myself. I know the section of the course when I moved away about half of the race and until the tower. I was familiar with that. The climb was okay, and it was easy to navigate. So I was familiar to being by myself and to refocus again. Then I joined Damian for some time. Then I moved away until the end of the fourth loop. And then no choice on the fifth loop, you're by yourself. I was very frustrated when John chose the clockwise because I was really afraid of the counterclockwise. I knew I was going to make some navigational mistakes. I just didn't know how long there were going to be, if there were going to be 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes mistakes. I was concerned about that. But then you have to deal with it and try to minimize the errors, of course.
Yeah. So let's go to... Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I was just saying, I didn't realize you and Carl were together that long. But yeah, Aurelian just had incredible pacing through this race. And again, to be your first year and do that much on your own, and then on loop four, surge like that. I mean, when I lost Damien and Albert on loop four, I thought, well, that's it. I'm alone. There's no one close to me. And then I get at the bottom of the last descent before heading into camp, and I look back up and I see a headlight starting down the switchbacks at the top, and I'm like, who is that? Like, how did that happen? Because I hadn't seen anyone for a while. So Aurelian was really moving. And yeah, I thought I was going to be able to get a quick nap before loop five, but I had to get back out quickly so I could choose that direction, which I wanted both for my confidence and personal reasons. But I kind of figured, you know, like when I was with Damien and considering who would go which way, in my head, I was like, well, I'm more confident clockwise. The people who are here for the first time, they're equally unconfident in either direction. So, you know, it doesn't matter, you know. It's
but really now in the end, yeah. I think it's more complicated for me at least, but it was okay.
Yeah, I mean there are just a couple of there are a few of the sections that I'm a bit less confident navigating in the counterclockwise direction. But you either nailed it or you did poorly and were just absolutely flying, one of the two. Because again, you had just amazing pacing throughout the race and an incredible fourth and fifth loop.
Yeah, thank you. And I was trying to compensate my errors during the fifth loop. I was jogging, running, whatever I was able to. And I did some mistakes, not critical every time, but I was still having a good pace, which saved my my loop. Yeah,
those little errors can add up and really do more damage than you think over the course of a race this long.
Yeah,
guys, it is a long race, both in terms of time and distance, and so many things can go wrong out there. At what point did you realize that, hey, I might finish this year? When did that realization come in that I've got a shot?
Last year, you've got to go into this thing expecting to finish. If you expect less, then that's what you're going to get.
Expectations Perfect. Are so important. Absolutely.
Yeah. I was believing it in it also. That's why I prepared for it. I was never sure about it. And I was pretty sure it was maybe going to happen during my fifth loop. Actually, after my fourth loop, when I finished my fourth loop, I was feeling like I had enough time. But you have to keep focus. You have to stay focused. You have to keep in mind whatever happened in the past during this race, that you can lose everything only at one book. So I was aware it may happen during my fourth loop, but I realized it will happen really at the end at the end of my last descent, because you have to keep focus. You have to avoid doing any mistakes before the end.
Yeah.
I always go into this thinking we have a little reservoir of time for mistakes or naps or whatever. And so if I can make it through the first couple of loops, you know, I think that the third loop is where the race really starts. The fourth is always the toughest. If I can make it to those loops and I still have my full reservoir, it kind of switches into disaster prevention mode, where I'm pretty confident as long as I don't make any huge stupid mistakes. And so that's the big focus, just prevent catastrophe and you're good.
So what happens? So you finish, or you're finishing loop four. Now you both know that you're fairly close. Is it a mad rush? What's happening at camp when you're trying to prepare for that fifth and very important loop and also go the direction you want to go and everything? What's going through both of your minds just knowing that this is your last chance with your crew? You better have everything you need, and you have an amount of time you can finish, but it's also pretty fickle too. You can't leave without things you're going to need out there. How do you approach going into that last time with your crew and then setting off for that final loop?
Yeah, on my side, it was a mix between wanting to rush to choose my direction. but I didn't want to race for that. I didn't want to sprint until the gate. So when I saw John that was ready, I stopped. I took my time. As you said, you have to be by yourself for the fifth loop. You don't have to rush. You really have to eat to get the proper equipment and everything. So I had a time where I started to move quickly, and I was thinking if John is taking a nap or if it takes more time, 10, 15 minutes, I was not aware really. I just choose my direction and I go. When I saw John that was ready and he stand up and move towards the gate, I decided to slow down, focus on my rest and whatever I need to do. I know that the direction now is it's done. So as you said, I was eating properly, making sure that I had my gear, and that was it.
Yeah, it was a bit of more of a rush than I expected. Again, I thought I was going to have a bit of time before loop five, and with Aurelian's big closing speed there on the second half of loop four, I didn't. And so it was a bit speedier getting back out than I expected, versus I thought maybe I would take a nap. But I have complete confidence in Feggy, John Fegaresi, my crew. Everything was ready. Everything was good to go. I knew what I needed to do. There were a few hiccups, like, you know, I switched my shoes and before realizing that I forgot to take off my tights and I had to take the shoes back off and take the tights off and put them back on. And, you know, a bit of that was again, more rushed than I thought it would be. There were definitely, Aurelian, if it's any consolation to you, there were times the first half of Luke 5 where I was definitely second guessing myself, and I was like, "God, I should have just taken the nap and let Aurelian choose the direction," because I was struggling bad on the first few hours of Luke 5.
So take us through that second half of loop five. I mean, you've been going for, you know, 50 hours, more than 50 hours at this point. You've got four and a half loops under your belt. What was that last half loop like? And take us through that final approach to the yellow gate. What's going through your mind? What's the reaction of everybody out there?
Well, you finished first, Aurelian, so you should go okay. First on this
one. I can
one.
Do that, yeah. My first half of the fifth loop was the most difficult to navigate on my side. Once I was at garden spot for the second half, let's say, it was easier. I was less concerned. So I was more executing, let's say, keeping the focus, of course. I was starting to have some pain on my right knee, then on my left ankles, but which was fine. I was just hoping it would not get worse. And I was going to go through it. It was the end coming soon, so it was fine. I had a struggle at some book, which was missing because the hiker removed it from the race. It was standing on the trails, and I was not able to find it. So that was concerning. I was pretty sure, I was 100% sure I was at the right place. There was nothing about the books, no pages, no plastic bags, nothing around me. So there was nothing else I could do except starting to move again. So that was frustrating. I was waiting. I mean, I was expecting for Laz to ask me, how do you have 12 pages instead of 13? And I was not able to answer, but I didn't find the books. So I was frustrated about that, but nothing else I could do. So I started moving again after 10 minutes, maximum, I think. And then, yeah, I had the margin. I had some time. I knew I was gonna finish. So I was really focused on every climb and the last descent. And then I got emotional at the end when I knew it was done. But yeah, it was a better fifth loop than I was expecting. I was managing the navigational errors in the right way, and my pace was better than I was expecting. So it was great for me.
What a nightmare situation! Someone takes a book while you're still out there on the course. I mean, that had to be just absolutely heart sinking to get there and know you're in the right place, but there's no book. I mean, that is I can't even imagine what's going through your mind at that point.
No, to be honest, it was okay. To be honest, myself, I knew I was doing it. I knew I finished the race. The books is for external validation, is for labs to approve that you're a finisher. On my side, I knew I was doing it. I was making my dream come true. I was feeling emotional at this time already, and then yeah, there was no books. So I was thinking the scenario. I was thinking that I would maybe not be an official finisher, but I was almost fine with that because I did my race. So that was the most important of everything.
Did you give yourself a set amount of time to look for the book, and then you were gonna just run it in from there? Or what was your process of thinking, well, I'm pretty sure it's right, I'm gonna look around, but then once you're absolutely sure you ran it in, did you have anything like that in your mind?
I knew exactly where it was. There was no doubt. There is a cairn where you have a lot of rocks that you have to take out in order to see the books. I took them out, all of them. There were no cairn anymore. Every rocks were on the floor. So I was pretty sure it was not there. Okay. And it was not around. I went 10, 20 meters around this. It was not there. So I didn't look at my watch. I was like, there is nothing else I can do. So I started to move again.
Incredible. What mental toughness to just stick to what you know. So that's incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you leave anything there at all? That's happened a few times in the past, and people have left, like, you know, a little wrapper or a bit of food or something at that spot to prove that they were there at least.
Yeah, I didn't think about that, but I didn't redo the cairn. I put the rocks on the, I let the rocks on the floor, so the cairn was not there anymore. So I was gonna tell that, okay. But I didn't. Yeah, that was only my story, let's say.
Or you could have gone with Damien couldn't find his first book on Loop 5, which was there. Damien was just in the wrong spot, and he decided that he was going to pick up a rock and a leaf and bring them back to Laz to prove that he was there. In his delirious state of mind, he's going to be like, look, here's a rock. I was clearly there. Yeah. But that, I mean, that's really just such an awesome statement and example, I think, of people who have success in this race. They're internally driven, and just exactly what you said there. Like, you knew that you did it. So does it really matter whether you had that irrefutable proof or not? It was you had the accomplishment, and those who know would know that you did it, and that includes yourself. Exactly. And that goes, you know, I also find it hard to believe in a lot of these things, like whether Barkley or other ultras are big challenges, like people try to cheat, and I'm like, these are personal things. How do you cheat yourself? And unless you can somehow go back and erase your own memory, like you always know what you did. So I mean, that's just awesome that was basically your takeaway of, I know I did it, so I'm gonna keep going.
Yeah. Did you guys see each other out there on that fifth loop?
Oh, we missed each other on that out and back section known as Leonard's Butt Slide. Mm-hmm. And it's a steep out and back that's overgrown and very undulating. It's one of those where there are a number of very close together kind of fingers running down the hillside. And so if you're on either side of that, just, you know, maybe 10 meters apart, you might not see each other. And so we missed each other there. I knew that he was there before me because his book page was gone. I saw Carl at the end. Carl was starting that as I finished it, and he said that he had seen early. And so we kind of saw each other by proxy, but not directly.
John, take us through the last half of that fifth loop for you and the finish.
So that half of the loop was great for me. Once I made it through that first section where I was struggling with sleep, I did get a little bit of a nap, garden spot about a third of the way through the loop. And so I had that to refresh me, and then I had daylight hours. And then at some point you kind of get the adrenaline of the finish just magnetically pulling you towards it, and that really helps overcome any remaining sleep deprivation. So my focus on that last half was just, again, don't screw up, just simple and methodical about everything. Getting some extra calories down at the tower. I had a whole thing of, like, I just took a whole extra sachet of Tailwind Recover and chugged it there with the water that I had to just get calories down, be sure I got the water that I needed, be sure I didn't make any mistakes, and to enjoy it, to actually be able to take that time to really process and appreciate and think about the close of the race this year. The first time I finished, it was raining and cold and foggy and miserable, and I was delirious, as I think is plainly obvious to anyone who saw me run up to the gate wearing a grocery bag as a poncho and a hat that I found out in the briars. This year, it was beautiful weather. I had the extra time. I was confident of it, and I got to, I mentioned the direction for personal reasons. The final, if you go clockwise, the final climb is on Chimney Top, which is a mountain that I spent a lot of time on as a kid with my family and our little family farm that's been there for 200 years is right at the bottom of that mountain. And so, I'd had this vision the first time I finished of you know, going up that climb and triumphantly getting to the top and ripping out my last page and looking down. And I didn't have that at all. And this year I did. It was a beautiful sunset as I climbed it. I got to the top. I sat and enjoyed it for a bit. And then just, as Aurelian said, the big moment for me in these races is never the finish itself. It's that moment that I know the finish is inevitable. It's just a formality. And so at that point, I knew all I had to do was jog back down an easy trail into camp. And so that was my moment to get to enjoy that and appreciate it before heading down.
Now, each of you finished with a little bit of time to spare, but whether or not we were going to have three finishes this year, that was seriously in doubt for some time. As we are waiting, I'm following Keith Dunn's Twitter feed. I'm like refreshing every 5 seconds, trying to figure out is Sabe going to finish or not. What was the atmosphere like as the clock was clicking down to 60 hours?
That part was really rough for me. It did feel a bit like 2017 for me, where we had Gary's terrible miss near finish there. And I was sitting there in camp looking out towards where Carl should be coming from and constantly doing the math in my head of, okay, well, I think I should see his headlight there. And from there, it's, if he runs well, it's 8 minutes back to the gate and he's got 15 minutes left. And, just constantly doing that mental math, like, can he still make it? And so, seeing him come in for that finish that close, and especially knowing everything that he's put into the race the past few years and how much it means for him, that was just an absolute awesome thing to see. And to be honest, selfishly also, I was sitting there thinking, come on, Carl, hurry up and finish. I hurt and I'm tired and I want to go home.
Yeah, for me too, it was interesting to see. Actually, it's the same for us. It's like we are in front of Twitter refreshing every time. We are looking, turning our heads around, and we don't know where Carrer is. So it's very intriguing to know if he's going to make it or not at the last minute. Then there is 15 minutes remaining, and we still don't know where he is. So it's concerning, and he makes it 7 minutes before the cutoff. So it's an amazing feat for him. He was chasing that for for so long. So I think it's a good relief for him to have made it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just I've always used my own first finish as the as an example of how the little things can add up. I now have Carl as an even better example, where, you know, if he had taken ever 7 seconds per hour, he wouldn't have finished. Like an additional 7 seconds per hour of the race, and he would not have finished. That's nothing. Like, absolutely not. That's stopping to, you know, undo your gel packet instead of doing it on the go. If you're looking at doing a Boston qualifying marathon, that's less than a second per mile. Like, it's you know, just absolutely tiny. And I can't imagine what was going through his head on that. You know, I got to say I enjoyed the last descent. It was nice. It was daylight. It was I was confident, had plenty of time, whereas I can't imagine him just constantly checking his watch all the way down that last descent, not being sure if he's going to make it.
So did you two treat it on that last lap as a race, or like against each other, or was it truly about that finish? And once you got there, it was an afterthought of who was first and who was second.
To me, I really did not care, honestly. Really, I think this is a wrong thing to do on the fifth loop. You really still have to focus on yourself. Mm-hmm. The race is never finished until it's finished. If you start racing against someone that you don't know where he is, and you don't listen to yourself, I think that's not the way to go if you really want to finish. I never felt like I was on a hurry because of that. I was focusing on my navigational mistakes and on my pace and everything. And to me, just being in the race this year was amazing. I was living my dream. Finishing on my first attempt was amazing. Finishing in front of everyone was a no care, honestly. And I was not pretending to do that. So I had never the feeling of that. When I finished, I thought John had finished already. Then people told me at camp that I was the first one to finish. I was surprised. I didn't feel any proud of that. Of course, the fact that I was faster than someone that is inspiring me so much is a good feeling. But I was never feeling the race going on until someone against someone else. So to me, it was not something I had in mind.
Yeah. I mean, the risk reward just isn't there. And especially having finished before, as everyone mentioned, if you get too focused on that and distracted by wondering what someone else is doing, you're much more prone to make a mistake that is going to cause you to not even finish, period. And so to risk not finishing in order to try to finish first is a difficult proposition. And it, you know, especially again, I wanted to be sure that I enjoyed it as well. Really, the only time that I was thinking about Aurelien on the fifth loop was in those early stages where I was trying to push myself and do the math and thinking, okay, if I make it to this book and fall asleep on this book, then will Aurelien get here in time to wake me up and still give me a chance to finish? That was the main concern on my mind for the first half of the loop, at least.
Yeah, I love that. And that's kind of the ethos of Barkley, just with, you know, send 40 souls out there and, you know, naturally fall into groups and work together. And I think that's one of the things that's pretty special about it. Just, I mean, even starting off, John, with you saying you wanted to show people kind of your home mountains, and Aurelien getting to run with your friend through one of the most experiences out there. Can you guys just kind of describe that whole feeling? Because everyone watching at home thinks of it as a race and Keith Dunn's putting up like the times people finish, but it feels like it's quite a bit more than that. And, you know, you want to give yourself a chance to finish by finishing loops in the right amount of time, but it really does feel like this thing that if one person every year tried it, there'd be very little chance of ever a finisher. But it's that camaraderie and teamwork, I think, that is pretty special. So you guys want to, maybe the feelings at camp or having crew or just this, because it's such a small campground and a tight-knit community, if you want to elaborate on that and let people know how special and how different it is from something we call a race.
Yeah, for me, it's all about community, as you said. I think we are about in the same, you have the same idea of the race. It's not about, having a lot of media or having a lot of people around the race, trying to preserve what it was, what it is right now. Being part of this community, which want to preserve this event, which is great. Sharing, as you said, it's a race, itself, and we have to work together for that. So partnership are very important, and I think we have to find fans doing that also. It's not all about suffering and accomplishment. It's about also finding books, like we are finding Easter eggs right now in the backyard. It's all about that also, and it's having fun. It's pushing our own limits, pushing the limits of the race together, and it's pretty fun. And I don't think you can find that in other events except this one.
Yeah, for me, I get a great deal of enjoyment and fulfillment out of doing what I can to help first-time people out there, with whether it be during the race itself or beforehand. I love kind of having, really mentioned he got a bit of satisfaction out of running faster than me, and I love that I have that like, if someone beats me at something like this, I want that to give them an extra feeling of accomplishment and achievement. And so if that's a target on my back while I'm out there, that's good fun for me. I will make them work for it. Otherwise it doesn't mean anything. but once we're out there, it's enjoyable to be with other people and to spend that time with them. But again, it's also very mutually beneficial, especially in the later stages, where you are inevitably going to have a moment where you lose focus and you make a careless mistake, and having other people there, the chances are much lower that you're going to make the same mistake at the same time and not be able to correct one another. So it's something that is practical and functional most of all, and when it no longer is, when you're having a negative effect on each other's races, then you separate. But Barkley, over the years, it's constantly evolving, it's constantly changing. It's a bit of an arms race, that the goal is to keep it at a 1% finisher rate. And so as the runners out there have gotten better, they've gotten better gear, they've gotten better strategies, they've gotten better training, they're now working as a team, they're now having quick loop changes, interloopal changes at the gate, all of these things, once they start being done, they almost become a necessity in the future, because the race evolves to counter that strategy. And then if you don't use that strategy, you're sunk. And so while it's definitely possible to finish the race completely by yourself, I feel like it's your chances are enormously lower to do it on the current course.
That's a great segue for me to ask this next question. John, this race has a cult following. Barkley has a lot of passionate followers, a lot of people involved and invested in this. And, Laz, he is larger than life. Is he solely responsible for organizing this and setting this up right now?
Some things have started to transition, which is great to see, as, he eventually will ride off into the sunset of a happy retirement, I hope. I imagine he'll still be there, I hope, as long as he can, for as many years in the future as that is. But he has started handing over some of the responsibilities for many of his races now, and it's great to know that they will be in good hands and continue on well into the future.
Now, have there been any thoughts or conversations about, with your experience and passion for the Barkley and your location, where you live, any involvement on your part, possibly in taking over some of that organizational responsibilities?
for the race?
I'll certainly help out and do whatever I can, with those things. And again, my family being right there, essentially with a mailing address that is all but at Frozen Head, if that's needed. I manage a Barclay fund. The race entry fee of $1.60 doesn't cover the race expenses. So there's kind of a Barclay donations fund, and I have a PayPal account that Laz is very averse to any sort of digital finance. So I have that, and then transfer and write him a physical check and send it in the mail. There are a few things I help out with, and I'm happy to do, but I'm not the one who will be taking over the race by any means.
And did you get carded buying cigarettes this year?
No, I didn't. I guess I've aged a bit. Last year I've never felt more sketchy of being in middle of nowhere, rural Tennessee, and I get carded trying to buy my cigarettes as my entry fee for the race, and I pull out my UK my British driver's license, and it's kind of like, what more sketch thing is there of someone having a fake ID than a foreign driver's license in Wartburg, Tennessee?
That's straight out of Superbad right there.
Yeah, and clearly, I don't sound British, so it kind of adding to the skepticism there. But it worked. I got him, so all good.
Yeah, I love Aurelian, that story.
What was Aurelian, as a Barclay version? What did you have to bring this year for Laz?
I brought a license plate. It was a license plate from when I was in Arizona with a Grand Canyon on it, which was the symbol of when I started the Ultra. And I had a French label on it. So, yeah, I think it was, that was only it. I only have to bring a license plate as a virgin.
So does that mean we count your finish as an American finish then? You brought an American license plate.
That's a good point. I don't know.
Aurelian was the first non-American to finish since the first finisher, Mark Williams, in 1995. True. So he's now one of three. He is also one of three people to never face the bugle. Brett Mounty and Ted Cave Dog Kaiser are the only two who were finished on their first attempt and never came back to fail in future years. So as of right now, Aurelian is one of those three.
Why not someday? Yeah. I would love to come back for sure. So we'll never know what will happen.
Aurelian, tell us about that reception you got when you got home. It looked pretty incredible.
Yeah, it was crazy. My girlfriend made this up. She called all my friends and my family, and they were here. So it was amazing. They've all followed along. They followed this. Yeah, a lot of them, I mean, my friends and the people around me knew that I was doing that. But then there were other people as well, my colleagues and the people who are doing trail running in France, who were following along more and more as I was making progress. So it was very important here. I had a good welcome. It was very nice to share. The first week was very busy for me, but it was such an amazing moment for me to share. So it was very special. Yeah.
Were you expecting that, or was it?
Not at all. Not at all. I was expecting just to go back to my normal routine first day, but I spent a little bit more time to do that.
I love how much France loves the Barclay, and I love that reception you got, and it's awesome that you've now given your country a finisher.
Exactly. Yes, I know. For many years, we've been failing as a nationality, as a country, as you said. So at least we have that already. So it's good.
Need to tell Alexis to get started on another book, or at least an appendix to add on to it.
Yeah, maybe something will be going on this topic. We'll see. We have a discussion ongoing with Alexis. We'll see.
All right. So what is the next big event for John and Aurelian? What's next on the horizon for you guys?
As we were discussing just a bit before the show, I have my sights on a big FKT this summer that probably isn't going to work out, but I think I'll redirect my planning to a different big FKT. And then I've got Tour de Géant in September, which is one of those that I've not yet had a good race at, so hopefully I can fix that this year.
About racing on my side, I just have one more event coming up in June, which is called Chartres Terminal Room. It's actually my hat right here. It's the French Barclay, let's say. I did it last year. I did 2.5 loops. It's a race that nobody finished yet, so we are all discovering if it's possible or not. It's either over the limit or at the limit. We still don't know. So very interesting. It's coming in June. And after that, my year of ultra running is done, and I'm going to focus on my my personal time, let's say. So I have this coming soon. I can't wait. It will be fun. And yeah, we'll see.
Okay, so there you have it. We are just about done here. I hope our listeners enjoyed our time with Aurelian and John. I want to thank them for joining us this week. Guys, how can our listeners keep up with you on social media, and where can they find updates on your latest adventures?
So I've got my blog at randomforestrunner.com. Don't get to post there as much as I would like anymore outside of race reports, but it's got links to all my social media on it as well.
Yeah, me too. Social media, I'm sharing time to times. I'm sharing my personal project most of the time. The Terminal Room soon, Instagram. So yeah, information can be found out there.
Okay, and how about you, Legend? Where can they follow you?
Just freeoutside.com has everything.
All right. Remember to check out the pod on social media as well. We are on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you have comments or clips you want to share, you can send it to me at johnfreakingmuir@gmail.com.
What have we not asked you?
And before we wrap things up today, just one more segment for you called What Have I Not Asked You That You're Dying to Tell Us About? What do we miss today, guys?
I don't know. We've done a pretty good job of covering things. Normally, I get people ask a lot more about my snack choices, but I think that info is well out there. My notorious sweet tooth. So I've been loading up on Little Debbie cakes and celebratory ice cream and pizza since the race. So. I think y'all did a good job of covering things here.
Aurelian, anything you want to leave us with?
No, not much. I think we covered it today. It was very interesting to discuss with you. Thank you guys for having us. I had a great time to talk with you, to Jeff, to John, of course, again. Nothing much else to add, but thank you.
Yeah, right. And I'll just, one thing with Barclay, it's unfortunate that more people can't get out there and do it. And so I think, though, that the idea of it, of just going out, taking on a big grand adventure and not being afraid of failing, finding something that you're passionate about, just get out there and do it. It doesn't have to be something that's already there. Make it up. I've done that before, and just enjoy it. Find what you love doing, and then do hard things in that area.
Some great advice right there. All right, we are finished. Thank you for coming on the podcast, guys. We wish you the very best in your future adventures, and we hope you'll consider coming back at some point and sharing some more epic stories. As we close up today, do you have any shout outs to friends and family?
All of them on my side.
The entire country, a particular of France. One.
Yeah, exactly. And to Guillaume, of course, which I spend the race with, if he's listening that. So yeah, everyone always.
Yeah, and always, especially my wife for me. She's been incredibly supportive as I've done these adventures. You know, she didn't marry an ultra runner, but now she finds herself married to one. And people ask if she crews for me, and she has the much more difficult task of managing our kids while I'm out stumbling around through the woods.
Okay. Well, thank you for tuning in. Always remember, the trail is the trail. It doesn't care if you want to go downhill. It doesn't care if it's almost dark and you're looking for a campsite. It doesn't even care if your watch alarm doesn't work. You need to take a dirt nap and somebody has taken a book off the course. Trail is the trail. Embrace the suck.